There's this really pervasive cultural myth surrounding the whole concept of the real estate mogul.
Oh, absolutely. The Hollywood version.
Right, exactly. We tend to picture this this aggressive overnight empire building exercise where success looks like aggressively acquiring city blocks before breakfast, getting highly leveraged, and just sprinting from one massive deal to the next.
Yeah, it makes for great television, but it's not reality.
Not at all, because when you look at the underlying mechanics of sustainable multi-generational wealth, it's much less like building an empire overnight and much more like planting an orchard.
I love that, an orchard.
Yeah, you don't get apples on day one.
Yeah.
And you have to strategically plant different types of trees, right? So that a single late frost doesn't just wipe out your entire harvest.
That orchard analogy captures the reality perfectly. I mean, the most successful investors aren't operating like sprinters trying to cross a finish line first.
Right.
They're making these methodical, heavily calculated decisions, and they start in the exact same place as any other investor with a single strategic
It's
acquisition.
just one tree.
Exactly. The difference isn't the speed of their capital deployment. It's the architectural framework they use to evaluate that very first step, knowing how it's eventually going to fit into a much larger ecosystem, over the next 20 years.
And that architectural framework, that is our mission for today's deep dive. We're extracting insights from a really comprehensive guide by Osul Gamma, specifically a section titled 3, How Investors Build a Property Investment Portfolio Over Time.
That's a great piece of source material. Very dense.
Super dense, yeah. So we are going to bypass the basic definitions today and just get straight into the advanced mechanics of portfolio construction. We're looking at the mathematical realities of capital efficiency, the structural differences between direct and fractional ownership, and really the specific mindset shifts that separate the short-term speculators from investors who actually engineer lasting wealth.
Which is a critical distinction to make, especially for those who already understand the fundamentals of real estate, but they feel constrained by the traditional bottlenecks.
Like capital lockup.
Right, capital and localized risk. The shift from simply, buying properties to actively engineering a portfolio, it changes the entire risk-return calculus.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the guide challenges a fundamental instinct that trips up a lot of otherwise really savvy investors.
The hunt for the deal.
Yes, the constant hunt for a good deal. You analyze the cap rate, you look at the price per square foot, and if the math works in a vacuum, you make an offer. But the text argues that this is fundamentally backwards.
Totally backwards.
Right. A successful portfolio doesn't start with a property analysis. It starts with a deeply personal strategic blueprint.
Because a good deal in a vacuum is essentially meaningless if it operates in opposition to your broader financial architecture.
Make that make sense for me.
Sure. Well, the source text highlights two contrasting profiles to illustrate this mechanism. Consider an investor who requires immediate liquidity, to supplement their monthly income,
Okay.
versus a hiring professional who is in their peak tax bracket and they're looking to park capital for a retirement that is, say, 2 decades away.
So those two profiles have entirely opposite structural needs. I mean, the high earner doesn't want more taxable income right now.
Precisely. If that high-earning professional buys a Class C multifamily property that generates massive monthly cash flow,
Which looks great on paper.
right, it might look like a phenomenal deal on a spreadsheet, but they are actually creating a tax liability for themselves. They don't need the yield today. They should be targeting Class A properties in emerging markets that offer tax-deferred equity growth.
Right, playing the long game.
Exactly. But conversely, the investor who needs yield today, they cannot afford to buy a low cap rate property in a gentrifying neighborhood, just hoping for appreciation in 10 years.
Because they have bills to pay now.
Right. They need immediate cash on cash return to cover their living expenses today.
It's kind of like walking into a massive grocery store without a shopping list or a recipe, you know?
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
Like you might find a giant industrial tub of flour on deep discount, huge sale. But if your goal is to make a salad, buying the flour is a highly inefficient use of your capital.
Yeah, you've tied up your resources in an asset that doesn't serve your ultimate objective. You can't put flour in a salad.
Exactly. So that alignment between the asset's function and the investor's objective, that has to be the ultimate decision-making filter. The guide frames it as a simple, continuous question.
Which is?
Does this specific investment, with its specific return profile, move me closer to my designated financial goal? And if it doesn't fit the blueprint, the cap rate is irrelevant. You walk away.
Which takes a lot of discipline, but once you define that goal and establish that blueprint, you inevitably run into a structural problem.
Right, the team building aspect.
Yes. And this brings us to the concept of portfolio architecture. The text uses a brilliant analogy here, noting that a winning team isn't made up of 11 goalkeepers.
11 goalkeepers. I love that.
Yeah.
You can't just copy and paste your first successful deal 10 times over and call it a portfolio.
What's fascinating here is that the 11 goalkeepers concept is a perfect illustration of correlation risk. A major misconception among active investors is equating the sheer number of properties they own with their level of success or security.
Right, like I own 12 doors, I'm doing great.
Exactly. But if you own 12 single-family rental homes in the exact same suburban zip code, targeting the exact same demographic of tenant, your assets are highly correlated.
Because they all react to the same local pressures.
Yes. You don't have a resilient portfolio. You have a single point of failure multiplied by 12.
Let me challenge that diversification point for a second, though.
Sure, go ahead.
Because Warren Buffett famously said that diversification is protection against ignorance, right?
Right.
And that if you know what you're doing, it makes little sense.
He did say that, yeah.
So if an investor has an intimate, granular understanding of their local market, I mean, they know the zoning boards, they know the reliable contractors, they know which side of the street commands higher rent. Why shouldn't they deploy all their capital into that one specific basket and just watch it very closely?
It's a common argument.
Doesn't spreading out across different asset classes or cities dilute their returns?
It's a very fair pushback, honestly, and the local expertise argument is strong when you are talking about microeconomic risks, like managing contractors or predicting local neighborhood gentrification.
Right, the stuff you can control on the ground.
But Buffett's quote doesn't protect you from macroeconomic systemic risk. The OSOL Gamma Guide touches on this, and they actually reference the Investopedia Guide to Portfolio Diversification to kind of ground the concept.
Okay, so macro versus micro.
Exactly. Let's say you are an absolute expert in a specific city, and you own 10 highly profitable commercial spaces there. Your micro knowledge is flawless. But if the primary industry in that city collapses, or if the municipal government passes a devastating new tax code, your local expertise cannot stop the macroeconomic bleed.
Right, because all your properties are swimming in the same water.
Yes. Your entire portfolio's revenue drops simultaneously because the underlying economic driver is identical for all 10 properties.
Okay. So true diversification isn't just about minimizing ignorance, it's about minimizing correlation.
Exactly that. It is about defensive architecture. You need your properties to perform different functions under different economic conditions.
Different positions on the field.
Right. You need the steady, reliable cash flow properties, your defenders, keeping with the sports analogy, to keep the lights on during an economic downturn. But you also need your strikers,
The aggressive growth ones.
the aggressive capital growth properties in emerging markets. They might be volatile in the short term, but they drive the overall net worth of the portfolio over a 20-year horizon.
The guide also points to an article called How to Evaluate an Investment Property Before You Invest, which seems to emphasize this exact point. Every time you consider adding a new asset, you aren't just evaluating its individual internal rate of return.
Right, you can't just look at it in isolation.
You have to run a diagnostic on how adding this specific property shifts the risk profile of the entire existing team.
Because if your portfolio is currently heavy on yield but vulnerable to inflation, your next acquisition shouldn't be another cash flow property.
Even if it's a great deal.
Even if it's a great deal, it needs to be an asset with high appreciation potential to balance the scale. You evaluate the asset based on the gap it fills in your lineup.
But, we all know the traditional mathematical roadblock to that 11 goalkeeper strategy, though.
Capital lockup.
Yes, capital lockup. If I want to build a beautifully uncorrelated portfolio with residential assets in one state, industrial warehousing in another, and commercial retail in a third, traditional financing models dictate that I need hundreds of thousands of dollars in locked up equity just to get through the down payment bottlenecks.
It's a huge barrier.
It really is. It forces early and mid-level investors into the exact concentrated risk we just warned against.
And capital inefficiency has historically been the primary barrier that prevents retail investors from executing institutional-grade strategies.
Because they just don't have the cash.
Exactly. The traditional model forces you to be 100% exposed to a single asset for perhaps a decade, just waiting until you can generate enough liquid capital to diversify into a second asset.
Wow, a decade.
Yeah, you are effectively carrying a massive, unmitigated risk burden during your most critical wealth-building years.
So let's look at the solution the guide proposes to bypass this traditional bottleneck. Because the text explicitly shifts focus to fractional property ownership as the mechanism to achieve day one diversification.
Yes. Fractional ownership completely reorganizes the timeline of risk management.
How so?
Well, instead of purchasing an entire physical asset, absorbing the entire debt burden, and locking up all your liquidity, you acquire a fractional share of an income-generating property
So you're buying a percentage of the equity.
and a corresponding percentage of the yield.
I can see how that solves the entry barrier, sure,
Yeah.
but I imagine it introduces a separate issue regarding control and structure. The source text mentions an article, Fractional Ownership versus REITs.
Right, real estate investment trusts.
Yeah, both models let you buy a slice of the pie, so to speak. Like instead of having to buy the entire bakery just to get some exposure to the pastry market, I could just buy a slice of the pie.
I like that. You get the flavor, the returns, without fronting the cash for the whole building.
Exactly. But if I want fractional exposure without buying the whole building, why wouldn't I just log into my brokerage account and buy shares of a publicly traded REIT?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the structural difference between those two vehicles is profound, and it really determines what you actually own.
Okay.
When you purchase shares in a REIT, you are essentially buying a stock in a massive blind corporate pool. You have zero say in the specific properties they acquire, manage, or liquidate.
So you're quite disconnected from the asset.
Very disconnected. Furthermore, because REITs are publicly traded, their share prices are often heavily correlated with the broader stock market, which means you introduce stock market volatility into your real estate allocation.
So you lose the fundamental advantage of real estate being an alternative, non-correlated asset class.
You dilute it significantly, yes. Plus, you're absorbing the corporate overhead and management fees of a massive institution. Fractional ownership, on the other hand, is entirely direct.
Direct in what way?
Well, you are typically entering a syndicate or an LLC that is tied to one specific physical address. You evaluate the specific building, the specific local market, and the specific tenant profile.
So you actually see the balance sheet for that specific property.
You see the balance sheet, you capture the specific asset's depreciation for tax purposes, and your returns are purely a function of that specific property's operational performance. It's completely decoupled from whatever the S&P 500 is doing that day.
That makes a lot of sense.
It provides the granularity and control of direct ownership, but with the capital efficiency of a pooled investment.
Let me push on the mechanics of that, though. If I own 100% of a duplex and I suddenly need liquid capital, I could put it on the market and sell it.
Right.
If I only own a 10% fractional slice of a commercial building, how hard is it to sell that slice if the other owners want to continue holding the asset? Liquidity seems like the obvious trade-off here.
Liquidity is absolutely the primary metric to evaluate when entering a fractional structure. Unlike a REIT that you can sell with a mouse click, fractional shares are less liquid.
Okay, so you are locked in to some degree.
To some degree, yes. However, modern fractional platforms, which align with the philosophies discussed by Osul Gamma, often operate their own secondary markets.
Oh, really?
Yeah, allowing investors to trade shares among themselves. Alternatively, the syndication agreement will clearly define the hold period, say, 5 to 7 years, at which point the asset is refinanced or sold and capital is returned.
I see.
The trade-off for that illiquidity is the premium you earn on the yield, and the structural ability to diversify your capital across five different markets today rather than waiting 20 years to afford five down payments.
It democratizes the defensive architecture. And that ties into Osul Gamma's broader operating philosophy highlighted in the text.
Education alongside the product.
Yes. They aren't just pointing out a financial product, they're emphasizing the pairing of fractional ownership with deep educational resources. They want the investor to fully understand the local economics of the slice they are buying, rather than just blindly trusting a fund manager.
Transparency is the goal there. Fractional models really only work if the investor is equipped to analyze the specific asset with the same rigor they would use if they were buying the entire building.
So, assuming an investor utilizes this fractional model, they avoid the capital trap, they successfully diversify their assets, and they have their 11 goalkeepers strategically mapped out.
Sounds perfect.
Right. But the moment you hold multiple assets across different markets, you introduce a new systemic problem, market drift.
Ah.
Because a portfolio is not a static document.
Far from it. The text makes a crucial point that a portfolio is a living ecosystem that requires active balancing.
Right.
Let's say you structure your initial portfolio to be an exact 50-50 split between high-yield cash flow properties and aggressive capital growth properties.
Yeah. A perfectly balanced approach for, say, a mid-career professional.
Yes. But real estate assets appreciate at wildly different velocities. 5 years later, your aggressive growth properties in a booming tech corridor might have doubled in value.
Right.
While your steady cash flow properties in a blue-collar manufacturing town appreciated by only 10%, suddenly your portfolio isn't 50-50 anymore.
Based on equity weight, you might now be 80% exposed to the growth market and only 20% exposed to the yield market.
Exactly.
So your portfolio drifted away from your original blueprint just by virtue of succeeding.
The market dictated a change in your risk profile. Furthermore, the investor's life has likely changed. 5 years later, they might be in a higher tax bracket, they might have children approaching college age, or they might have shifted their retirement horizon.
Right, life happens.
And the assets they hold today might no longer serve the goals they have today.
But rebalancing in real estate isn't like rebalancing in IRA, where you just click a button to sell tech stocks and buy bonds.
No, not at all.
Real estate has massive friction. You have broker fees, capital gains taxes, closing costs. You can't just frantically trade properties every time the market twitches.
And you shouldn't. The guide clarifies that portfolio evolution is deliberate, not reactive. You conduct scheduled, rigorous audits of your holdings against that primary filter question we talked about earlier.
Does this current lineup of assets still support my future?
Exactly. If a property has maximized its appreciation curve, or if the return on equity has dropped because the property is now worth so much more but the rents haven't kept pace, you execute a strategic exit.
Right.
You might use a 1031 exchange to defer taxes and roll that massive equity into a higher yielding asset. It is a calculated pivot.
Which perfectly sets up what the text identifies as the absolute most overlooked yet vital quality in investing. We obsess over interest rates, we debate macroeconomic trends, we analyze zoning laws, but the true secret ingredient isn't a metric, it's patience.
Patience in real estate is fundamentally different than patience in other asset classes.
Why is that?
Because time literally changes the mathematics of your investment. Every single month you hold a property, tenant rent is paying down the principal balance of your debt through amortization.
Yay.
And simultaneously, inflation is generally driving up both the replacement cost of the building and your rental income.
So the spread between your debt and your equity is mechanically widening every month, regardless of whether you do anything at all.
The math does the heavy lifting. The text notes that lasting wealth is rarely generated by one exceptional lottery ticket speculation.
Like trying to flip a house in a month.
Right. It is built by making a series of fundamentally sound decisions, managing the correlation risk, and then allowing compounding and amortization the time required to work.
You just have to wait.
Markets will inevitably cycle through periods of extreme volatility and stagnation. Patience is the psychological anchor that prevents you from liquidating a fundamentally sound asset during a temporary panic.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me, though. The aha moment in this text isn't just a reminder to be patient. It's a completely counterintuitive reframing of how beginners should view their very first acquisition.
Oh, this is a great point.
The guide points out that your very first investment does not have to be perfect. And frankly, it's not going to be perfect.
No, but the paralysis of analysis stops so many potential investors from ever deploying capital.
They just freeze.
They are terrified of making a suboptimal choice, so they do nothing.
But the text reframes the value of that first property. It argues that the primary hidden value of your first acquisition isn't necessarily its immediate cash flow or its five-year equity bump. The primary value is data acquisition. You're essentially subsidizing your own tuition.
That is a phenomenal way to understand it. When you buy that first asset, even fractionally, you are no longer learning from theoretical spreadsheets.
You're in the game.
You are plunged into the real-world localized economics of that specific market. You quickly learn the realities of vendor pricing for maintenance. You learn the nuances of how local tax assessments are calculated.
Right.
You gather real-time data on tenant demographic shifts and lease renewals.
So even if that first property slightly underperforms the broader market, the granular localized data you extract from it effectively de-risks your next three purchases.
Yes.
You weren't just buying an imperfect asset. You were buying the operational intelligence required to successfully scale the rest of your portfolio.
It fundamentally lowers the psychological barrier to entry. You realize you aren't making a high-stakes forever decision that will make or break your net worth.
Right. It's just step one.
You are making a foundational decision to acquire the market literacy that will make your second, third, and fourth investments exponentially sharper. Growth happens one well-informed, data-driven decision at a time.
We have covered incredibly dense territory today, moving from the myth of aggressive accumulation to the calculated reality of portfolio architecture. Let's synthesize the core, actionable takeaways from the Osul Gamma text so you have a distinct roadmap.
The foundational takeaway is that success is entirely decoupled from property quantity. The number of doors you own is a vanity metric.
Just 11 goalkeepers.
Exactly. True success is engineered by aligning specific asset types with your evolving financial blueprint.
Secondly, diversification isn't just about owning different properties. It's about owning non-correlated properties. You're building a team that serves different defensive and offensive functions, shielding you from localized macroeconomic shocks.
Thirdly, if traditional capital lockup is your bottleneck, fractional ownership is the mechanism that allows you to deploy that diversification strategy immediately.
Without needing $1 million in cash.
Exactly. It bypasses the down payment trap while maintaining the control and tax advantages of direct ownership.
And finally, your first acquisition is fundamentally an educational expense. It is a data gathering exercise that buys you the market literacy required to build lasting wealth. So, as you sit with all these mechanics, it brings us back to you. The reality of real estate isn't found in a Hollywood movie, and it isn't built on chasing short-term trends. It is engineered through structural planning and capital efficiency.
Hmm.
So, what does this all mean for you?
Which leaves you with an incredibly important question to evaluate moving forward. We established that the perfect first investment is a myth, and that its highest value is the operational intelligence it forces you to acquire. So looking at your own financial horizon and the goals you were trying to reach, what is the specific tuition you are willing to pay right now?
Yeah, it's the real question.
Instead of remaining paralyzed by asking, will this specific property make me wealthy? Or reframe the equation. Ask yourself, what localized data and operational intelligence is this first acquisition going to provide me? And how will that data dictate the investor I become a decade from now?
It completely changes the risk profile in your own mind. You stop worrying about buying an empire. And you simply focus on planting that first, highly strategic tree. That is all for this deep dive. Go out there, define your blueprint, and start gathering your data. We'll catch you on the next one.